This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It takes guts to tell stories about yourself when you find those stories to be painful. Actually, it takes a masochist, but Mike Birbiglia isn't a masochist, at least I don't think he is. Mike Birbiglia is a comedian. You've seen him on Comedy Central and all of the late-night shows. You hear him regularly on This American Life, and now he's coming to Charlotte to tell of the painful episode of his life, up close and personal, well, as up close as you can get from the stage of the Night Theater. It's the Painfully True Stories Tour, the companion piece to his book Sleepwalk With Me and Other Painfully True Stories, and the pain and the laughs begin here, this hour, as we welcome Mike Birbiglia. Thanks for joining us.
How are you?
Great.
that is some kind of intro.
Well, that's what they pay me for.
Yeah.
Now, you have to live up to it. You have to live up to it now, okay?
I know. I think the point that made me shake was when you said the painful episode that is his life.
Well, that's because I left the S off. That was my mistake. But it may fit.
I like the singular of that. The episode that is his life. Oh, man, what have I become?
That's right. You have to ask yourself that a lot, I guess, in your business.
I think it's refreshing, actually. It's refreshing on today, election day, that my book has nothing to do with politics at all.
That's true.
It's just personal. It's just personal stories.
Now, that could be why you're so popular, because if you talked about politics, you would be bound to offend somebody. You can't offend
anybody.
You
polarize people. Yeah. The only thing I talk about in my book that's even remotely political is cable news. I have a complete and unhealthy addiction to cable news, and I think it's because they hook you in with the laser sound effects and questions you couldn't possibly know the answers to. You know, they'll be like, "Pachoo, do you know what's in your soup?" And I'm like, "Oh my God, I guess I don't know what's in my soup. I gotta stick around. What is this, a commercial for Toyota? All right, I'll watch this just as long as you tell me what's in my soup." Then they'll be like, "Pachoo, it's broth." I'm like, "I knew it. I knew it was broth, but I wasn't 100%. I'm glad I stuck it out." And then they'll be like, "Pachoo, do you know it's in your broth?" I'm like, "I can't believe this. How long do I have to watch before they tell me all the answers?" But I'm actually trying to wean myself from cable news, and maybe I'll try and stop tonight.
Okay. I hope you're successful.
It's hard.
You know, for a guy who has made a living telling painful stories about himself, about all aspects of your life, how bad did it hurt when the New York Times called your one-man off-Broadway show Sleepwalk With Me simply perfect?
It was, you know, very satisfying. And exciting. It was very nerve-wracking when you have a one-person show and there's this kind of massive judgment impending. And it's, because the reviews are going to come out in a matter of days or weeks as you're putting it up. And it was kind of a culmination of like 6 or 7 years of work. And so you hope that it goes well, because, you know, with solo performance and autobiographical writing, it's not like a novel or a play or a movie where people don't like it. They can go, "Well, we didn't like this character, this aspect." You know, with your own personal writing, they're basically saying, like, "We don't like you."
Mm.
You know, your personality, that whole thing isn't working for us. So, you know, it was nerve-wracking. So that was a real relief.
Yeah, but you know, you had some very good people involved in that project, both in the directing capacity and other capacity. But and Nathan Lane made his producing debut, producing your show. How did that come about?
Yeah, well, he had come to a show I had done at Caroline's in New York City, which is a club that's on Broadway, kind of a famous comedy club in New York City, and I didn't know him or anything, but he was in a David Mamet play on Broadway called November.
Right.
And I think it was like a 10 o'clock or 10:30 show. It was after his show, and he came, and I was very nervous when I heard they told me that he was in the audience. And then he didn't come backstage, but then the next night he sent a note to the theater telling me how much he liked the show, and and that he liked all these aspects of the show that actually I was working on for the upcoming one person show, Sleepwalk With Me. And so that was really exciting. And then we went out and had dinner. I went and saw his play, and my girlfriend at the time, Jenny, and he and I went out for dinner, and we just hit it off real well. And he said, you know, what if I presented your show, so to speak? And I said, you know, that would be kind of a fantasy. So it was, you know, it really was. I mean, when the mayor of Broadway, yeah, says you're okay, it's an exciting thing.
So it helps to have his name on the show.
It was big for there's a sort of theater mafia in New York, a group of people who see everything that theater snobs put their stamp on, and I think by Nathan putting a stamp on the show, a lot of people came who maybe wouldn't have come.
You know, people know you, as I said earlier, from your appearances on late night TV and on Comedy Central, mm-hmm, and several of your specials there, and This American Life and The Moth and things like that. And they just assumed, well, you know, he's always been here. But you have to start someplace.
Yeah. I have a severe identity crisis. I'm on all of these different opposing outlets. Go ahead.
But I was going to say, you have to start someplace, and people just assume that you blossom full-blown onto these shows, but you don't. There's a lot of what comes before. What did come before? How long were you out there in the trenches?
You know, I've been doing comedy for about probably 13 years or so.
You're not that old.
Yeah, I'm 32, I started doing, when I was in college, I went to Georgetown but I didn't really go, in the sense that I didn't go to classes all that much.
That's an expensive school not to go to, isn't it?
I know. Well, you're telling my dad. My dad was not thrilled with that, you know, because I was in school, and I shouldn't it'd be completely misleading. I was going to the classes I enjoyed and understood, like English classes, reading and writing. I was an English major and a theater minor. And so I'd go to those classes, but it was the requirements that really hit me hard. At one point I took a class called Introduction to Computers and Networks, which was at, 8:30 in the morning, and I went to the first class, mm-hmm, and it was way over my head. They were talking about computers, and then the next morning when I woke up for class, I was just like, you know, I don't know if I really want to go to class, and because that's the thing, you get that freedom in college, you don't really have to go for the first time. And so I never went to class again until the class before the final, to find out what would be on the final, which is always a really good plan. And I showed up a few minutes early, and I sat down, the guy next to me, who was kind of my safety. You know, in classes, you always have that one person who you think, well, this person can't possibly do better than me. I mean, this is this one safety person that, even on my worst day, there's no way I can do worse than this person. And he, my safety, said to me, he goes, do you think we'll get back the final? And it kind of came to me in waves. I was just like, we took the final? Like, oh no. And I sprint out of the class to the computer science department, and there's my professor, and I say hello, because I didn't know his name. I said, I'm in your class. I misunderstood the syllabus, and I missed the final. And he didn't even look at me. He just looked at the floor, and he goes, well, you know, you get the worst grade. And I didn't even know what that meant. You know, I was kind of looking around like, you know, I was thinking, should I leave? I mean, what should I do here? And then I said, does that mean I get a zero? And he goes, it means you get the worst, the grade that the person who did the worst on the test got on the test. Well, as it turns out, the person who did the worst on the test passed the test. So I passed the test, and I passed the class, and I am proud to be an American. I think that's the moral of the story, is I'm proud to be an American. It's what a smart group of people,
you know,
I was in school with.
I went to a school right down the road from Georgetown. I went to University of Maryland. I have a similar story. I went to the first
I performed at University of Maryland 3 days ago.
Really? Well,
yes, I did.
I hope you said hi to the Terps for me.
I was in the field house. Yeah, it was great.
So that's a big house to play. Boy, I tell you.
5,000 people. It was myself and Dimitri Martin were there together.
So I went to the first day of my anthropology class. I think I was a sophomore. And instantly I knew this is not what I thought anthropology was going to be.
The question is, what did you think it was going to be?
I thought it was going to be interesting. And guy was just not interesting to me. Of course, it was the first day. But it was an 8 o'clock class. And I thought, well, I'll come back later when, you know, maybe when he warms up. And when I came back, they were handing back the midterm.
Oh, wow.
And I walked up to him after class and I said, what can I do? He said, you can take an F and get out. So you had better luck than I had.
Wow. And so you failed the class.
Oh, yeah. I failed the class.
Oh, man. That was always my deepest fear, you know, because I just didn't want to let down my dad. You know, my dad is a very kind of...
He's a doctor.
He's an academic type. Yeah. He's a doctor, and he got his law degree kind of in his free time, which is an intimidating thing to do. And when you're a kid, you're just like, how am I going to live up to this? And then becoming a comedian was probably the worst thing I could possibly do. I mean... It's like my dad worked his whole life to send me to college, and then I got a job making fun of him in front of strangers. So that whole plan kind of backfired.
Does it? Obviously, when you first said, I'm going to be a comedian, he was probably apoplectic.
He was. That's a good way to describe it. He was not open to it. He said, and I mean, not only was he not open to it, he just didn't understand it, and so he would get angry. You know, my dad's the kind of guy who gets mad a lot, but he's not even sure why. He'll be like, damn it, I'm eating pretzels, you know, and we're like, is he angry, is he hungry, what is the emotion being expressed, you know. You know, but he, in this instance, he was just like, well, you know, well, school is your number one priority. And I was like, okay, you know, but it just wasn't. And then he didn't really understand, because I was working the door at the DC Improv Comedy Club. I got a job like running food to tables and being a busboy and that kind of thing and selling tickets. But my dad had never been to a comedy club. So when I told him this, he was like, comedy club, what do they do? Strip? And I was like, no, they perform comedy, you know, and so then it was just kind of a secret, to, the whole comedy thing for a while, which is actually fitting with my dad's kind of understanding of the world or what he taught me, which is my dad, when I was growing up, always said the phrase, don't tell anyone, but not about creepy things. I don't want to lead you down the wrong path. You know, it would just be sort of, you know, insignificant things. Like, I wouldn't make the soccer team, and you'd be like, don't tell anyone. I was like, they're going to know when they show up to the games and I'm not on the team and I'm crying.
Well, don't tell anyone. We have to take a break. We're going to come right back with more. Mike Birbiglia is our guest. The Painfully True Stories Tour at the Knight Theater on Friday at 8. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the U.S. National Whitewater Center. Fall is the time to be outdoors with the Cool Sport Pass, providing unlimited access to kayaking, rock climbing, zip lines, and more. USNWC.org. And James McElroy and Deal, counsel for the life of your business. Practical solutions to everyday and unforeseen problems. Serving the Charlotte area for over 50 years. Details at jmdlaw.com. Well, in this part of the country, we are so surrounded by them that we probably don't give them much thought. They certainly beautify the world. They clean the air. They, in fact, make life possible. But some of them are really quite bizarre. And that's what we're going to focus on tomorrow. Bizarre botanicals. Two local botanists have teamed up to write a book on what they call the circus clowns, magicians, and tattooed ladies of the plant world. So we'll take a look at all that tomorrow morning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, understanding new threats from Al-Qaeda, foil package bomb plots by suspected militants, and what they mean for covert action in Yemen and expansion of U.S. military options there.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 FM, WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and our guest today is Mike Birbiglia. He's a comedian and a storyteller, mostly a storyteller. And you've heard him on This American Life. You've seen him on television on all these comedy channels and on Letterman and Jimmy Kimmel, etc. His new book is called Sleepwalk With Me and Other Painfully True Stories. And he'll be at the Night Theater on Friday evening at 8 o'clock with more of the same. As I sit here and talk to you, there hasn't been a sentence that has not been funny.
Oh, and thank you.
And you're just winging
That's
it.
The hope.
I know, but you're just talking. Is your regular life like this, or do you turn it on when you're on radio or television, and you just turn it off when you're in real life?
My wife would not agree with you that I'm funny all the time. I don't know. I mean, I have. People often accuse me of being drunk or high when I'm not. That's just how I talk, I think. So I think I inherently, because I have kind of a laid-back demeanor, I think that kind of adds comedy to things accidentally.
I mean, how long have you known that you were funny, that you have this little twisted take on the world?
Well, when I was in high school, I saw my brother took me to see Stephen Wright. You know Stephen Wright? Right?
Actually, I don't know Stephen Wright. No.
Oh, Stephen Wright is like he's a brilliant comedian who's still working and was kind of a legendary one-liner comedian who has very low energy and he kind of talks like this. He's got a Boston accent, but he's like, he has a lot of one-liners like, I went to a drive-in movie in a taxi cab. Movie cost me $95. he's like a brilliant comic, and I saw him at the Cape Cod Melody Tent. I grew up in Massachusetts when I was in high school, and I laughed so hard. I had that laughter that one sometimes has, you know, where it hurts, you know, like it hurts your body. And I was just like, I gotta do that. You know, I have a track record in my life, of kind of adopting things as career paths that other people would just go, oh, I think that's kind of interesting. And I'm like, I'm going to do that. Like when I was a kid, like my brothers and sisters took me to the movie Breakin'. Do you remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
There was Breakin' and Breakin' 2, Electric Boogaloo, which was about these breakdancing movies. And we went to the movie theater, and there's no one in the theater other than us and this other mother and son. And so we started breakdancing along with the movie. And we walked away, and everybody else thought, well, that was a really good time. And I thought, I'm going to be a professional breakdancer. That's what my life's path is going to be. My dad's a doctor and I'm a breakdancer. And my siblings kind of cheered me along. They were like, you're really good at this, which is what older siblings do when they want to taunt their younger siblings, is they just convince you that in fact your delusional thoughts are correct and pinpoint, you know, on point. And so they would invite their friends over, and they would go, Mike, breakdance, you know, and then I would flop around on the floor and do things, and they would be like, this is amazing. You should be the instructor of this. And so I had a lot of these kind of delusions in my life. Growing up, I wanted to be a comedian, a rapper, a breakdancer, the owner of a pizza restaurant where third graders could hang out. You know, I just had so many goals. And then comedian is the one that I ended up just going with. I don't know why exactly.
Yeah, what do your siblings do?
Well, my brother Joe writes with me. He's actually, he collaborates with me on a lot of stuff and runs my company. You know, we produce things various TV and film things. And
so
he
too has fallen down in the eyes of your father.
Yeah. He was going down the straight and narrow for a while. He was an advertising copywriter, and then I kind of convinced. He's my older brother, but mm-hmm. but he was in a more kind of stable existence, and then once I kind of got my sea legs in comedy, I was able to convince him to come and work with me. Mm-hmm. And then my sister Gina worked in television for a period of time, and now she's a full-time mom. And my other sister Patty works in consulting. And so I don't know. I'm very close with my siblings. I'm the youngest of four, and they kind of that's how they were able to kind of convince. That's why I kind of needed the attention of the big Italian family, and that's why I ended up being kind of this attention-starved lunatic.
You have a whole chapter in your book, Sleepwalk With Me and Other Painfully True Stories, called Delusional, in which you say that to be a comedian, you have to be delusional.
Yeah, I believe that, because you have to tell yourself it's going well when it's really not going well, because otherwise you wouldn't get on stage.
But surely
just
I guess
human beings don't like me, so I won't do this again.
Yeah, because you know instantly if it's not going well. How can you delude yourself? I mean, if you're standing out there and you got flop sweat because no one is laughing, and maybe that's never happened to you, I don't know.
Sure it has.
Well, surely you know it's not going well then, right?
Well, you'd think so. A rational human being would draw that conclusion. But I think that, what happens is you take what is a chuckle or a titter or a small laugh, and then you kind of you compound it and multiply it in your head, and you just focus on, it's extreme optimism. You just go, this is going pretty well. That little teeny laugh, that's a big laugh.
In your book, you talk about, I think it's the first time, maybe it was the second time, I don't remember, that you went out and did this. You got a gig to open for a comedian at a club, and you had like four jokes, and you had to do 30 minutes.
Yeah, that was the one of the problems starting out is you'd be like, yeah, that was at a place called Fat Tuesdays in Virginia, and they asked me to do 30 minutes of comedy, and what I should have said was I only have about 11 minutes of comedy tops, and what I did say was so I show up to the Fat Tuesdays and I'm backstage, which is just the sidewalk of a strip mall, and I'm scared to death because I don't know what's going to happen after the 11 minutes elapses, and they open the door and they go, "Mike, you're on," and I turn around and I just throw up on the sidewalk because my body couldn't think of another plan. It was just like, what do? Let's get rid of some food. And then and I walk on stage and I hear the person on the loudspeaker introduce me. They go, "Please welcome Mike Bohuski," and I was just so mad. I was just like, you didn't even try. You just said B and then whatever you could think of, and you made me Polish, and that's a really specific choice. And I walked on stage and I did 4 minutes of comedy, because when you're bombing, it pairs down. And then I drove home to my girlfriend at the time, Abby, and she said, "How'd it go?" And I said, "It was amazing, because in my mind it had been, and if it hadn't, I wouldn't have gotten on stage again."
Yeah, but they offered you $50 for 30 minutes. You did 11. They still gave you the $50, and they asked for a glossy, an 8x10 glossy.
Yeah.
Because you were coming back.
When you're starting out, they you go to these comedy clubs that are really not even comedy clubs, and I imagine in Charlotte there's a few of these here and there. It's just like a bar with a comedy night, uh-huh. and really all the opening acts are really just kind of buffers for the headliner. And so, all they want you to do is just do something until the headliner shows up. It's like they don't even care. I mean, they're just trying to sell drinks is the bottom line. And you don't even know that when you're starting out. You're like, this is about the integrity of the comedy. And it's not. It really isn't.
So looking back on it, did you bomb that night or were you pretty good? I mean, they gave you the $50.
No.
They asked for a picture. They wanted you back. I mean,
No, it was terrible.
Terrible.
Looking back, I mean, I this is how I look at comedy. When it's going well, it feels like you're performing jazz. You know, you're just like, you know,
but then,
yeah, exactly. You're rolling and then sometimes you have to remember that sometimes jazz sucks. You know, like, what if you're the Kenny G of comedy? Like, what if you think you sound like this, like, and in fact you sound like this, na 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 na. Because you know, when he plays that song, he thinks he's rocking. You know, he's like, I'm feeling it. And you know, they're like, his friends are like, Kenny, that song's not very good. And he's like, I know that one ain't good, but how about this? No, 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 no. And they're like, Kenny, that's the same song. You're the worst musician ever, and we're your friends. This is an intervention. It's a very fine line.
Yeah. Comedy, to me, would be the most frightening thing in the world, because it is you naked up there. Your jokes, your material, your life in your case.
It really is, yeah.
And for a guy who has had this painful life that you write about and talk about in your stories, how did you have the guts to get up there and potentially create even more pain for yourself?
No career prospects. No other opportunities. I don't know. I mean, that's a really good question. I think when you're a comedian, you know, there's this whole issue of like, laughing with versus laughing at, mm-hmm. you know, that's always the question when you're a comedian or when you're a kid, you know, remember when you're a kid and your parents ask you that question, like, you know, Mike, are people laughing with you or are they laughing at you? And, you know, and I think as an adult, you have to ask that question as well. Sometimes maybe more often than I do. You know, I think, as a comedian, you're always being laughed at, whether you realize it or not, but you're controlling, when you do it as your job, mm-hmm. you start to control the how and when you're being laughed at. So you get to control the narrative a little bit more of being laughed at, because I do think that I have this habit that never seems to go away of making awkward situations more awkward. And, you know, I really do. And, you know, my best example I always give people is like a few years ago, I was moving a new bed into my apartment, and this woman who lived in the building opened the front door for me with her key. And she said, I'm not worried because a rapist wouldn't have a bed like that. That's how she started the conversation. Now, what I should have said was nothing. And what I did say was, you'd be surprised, and there's nothing you can say after that. You're just like, see you around the building, you know, that kind of thing. Because I think there's something wrong with my brain. I don't have an on-deck circle for ideas, you know. It's just batter up, and a lot of the ideas are bad, and they're at the plate going, I don't know about this one, Mike. And I just turn into this drunk Little League dad. I'm like, you go take some cuts, son. And that's never going to go away.
Maybe that's why your father said don't tell anybody all the time.
Yeah, well, I think you hit
he
it
saw
right
that
on the
in
nose.
You.
he was right.
Mike
He's
Birbiglia.
What a wise man.
Yeah, Mike Birbiglia is our guest. He's in town on Thursday night, Friday night at 8 o'clock at the Knight Theater. When did you stop telling jokes and start telling stories?
I think it was around 2003. I was asked to perform stand-up comedy at the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen, Colorado, and also that year they were programming the Moth storytelling series, mm-hmm. which is also a podcast, which is now a podcast and a public radio show, and they basically coach you and explain to you how to tell stories. And they asked me to tell a story. And so I think that was the first time. And I told this story that was so embarrassing, that I later told on This American Life, which is that When I was in high school, I had my first girlfriend. I'm just going to paraphrase, but I had my first girlfriend, and it was so exciting that I was willing to overlook certain red flags. And one of them was that my girlfriend had another boyfriend in another town, and they were in the process of breaking up, of course, but that his parents were sick, and so I had to, you know, kind of be understanding to that. And so I kept thinking, oh, she'll break up with him eventually. And then eventually she invites me to meet her parents. And I drive to her parents' house and I meet them. It's going pretty well. And then this other guy comes over and his name is Scott. And it's slowly dawning on me that I'm actually hanging out with my girlfriend's boyfriend. And it's going pretty well, you know, and He suggests that we go hang out at his house, and I meet his parents, and it's an indescribable feeling meeting your girlfriend's boyfriend's parents for the first time, because part of you is angry for obvious reasons, and then part of you still wants to make a good impression. You know, you're like, maybe if this goes really well, she'll see that I'm good with parents in general, you know, but that was the point at which I was kind of staring the truth in the face, and I remember thinking, I'm never gonna let that happen to me again. And that's actually the title that ended up being the title story of my follow-up one-man show, which I'm working on right now. Mm-hmm. for this winter, called My Girlfriend's Boyfriend.
When you craft these stories, and maybe you don't, maybe you just tell them, surely you craft these stories for an audience, because
eventually, yeah.
I mean, what's the process? Because as you're talking to me, this is just coming off the top of your head, you're funny. Do you really have to spend a lot of time crafting things and shaping the stories so that there are highs and lows, peaks and valleys, there's a pace and a flow and a punchline here and a guffaw there? Or does it just happen for you?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of crafting. You know, a lot of times your instinct is to not tell the most revealing or most painful part of a story. Mm. And that actually, this particularly became apparent when I was writing this book, those are the most important parts. Mm. The parts where you're most vulnerable and you're most compromised and you're making decisions that are less than intelligent or wise. Those are the most interesting stories because they're the most relatable. And they're ultimately the most cathartic for the audience to read because, you know, what's remarkable to me is, you know, you write these stories, like that story I just told you about meeting my girlfriend's boyfriend's right. parents. I've told on stage a bunch and what's remarkable to me is, that pained me to tell that story for a while. And then what I discovered is many people would say, that happened to me too, which I think is amazing.
Yeah, I want to come back to that because I had a question about that. We'll continue that line of questioning in a moment or two. Mike Birbiglia with us, the Painfully True Stories Tour Night Theater, Friday evening, 8 o'clock. Come right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Sardis Baptist Church, an inclusive congregation where women are pastors, children lead worship, and theological diversity is valued. 5811 Sardis Road or online at sardisbaptistcharlotte.org. And by Integrity Capital Management, supporting CPCC-TV's show Charlotte, a city of international success featuring Charlotte's international heritage and diversity. Details available at Integrity.com. Foiled mail bombing plots to the U.S. by extremists in Yemen has added urgency to an Obama administration review of expanded military options in that country, including increased covert operations. Diane Rehm and her guests will talk about the implications of new terrorist threats from Al-Qaeda in Yemen. By the way, our guest Mike Birbiglia joins us here in town on Friday evening at 8 o'clock at the Knight Theater, and you can join him now, 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE. Or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talk.
WFAE is searching for a senior-level professional to join one of the top-performing news talk stations in the country and lead our fundraising efforts. This includes strategy and oversight of membership and business support. Experience in public radio or nonprofit development is preferred. Please see complete details at WFAE.org/jobs. Applications are being taken online only. WFAE is an equal opportunity employer.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Mike Birbiglia, our guest. He's coming to town Friday evening, as I've said, 8 o'clock, Night Theater, 704-372-1000 for information or tickets to the Blumenthal Performing Arts Center. We were talking just before the break about what it's like to tell really painful stories, and you mentioned that it's cathartic for you after a while, and that for the audience, they kind of relate to it because they say, well, you know, we went through that too. And as I was reading through your book, I was thinking, oh, you're sitting there talking about your first sexual experience and things like that, which are awkward and other things. And I'm thinking, everybody's had that experience. And the joke's on them because you're profiting from telling the stories that they already know.
Yes, the whole thing is a ruse. I have tricked them all because it happened to them too.
That's right.
Yeah, no, I mean, I always say that to my dad because my dad is very uncomfortable with me telling personal stories, and he'll always say, you know, you should stay away from the personal stuff. And I'm like, that's my whole, I swear to God, I'm like, that's my whole book, it's my whole show.
He doesn't get this, does he? He doesn't get it at all, does he?
Well, I make this point, and this is my defense always, which is if people are laughing, then it means that everybody is experiencing it. If people aren't laughing, then I think he has a point. You know, because if people are laughing, then they're identifying with what's happening.
Well, you know, in the foreword, I think it's the dedication to your book, you say, to my parents, Vincent and Mary Jean, if it weren't for your support of my many delusions, I would not have been able to write this book. Also, don't read the chapters about yourselves. Also, I love you. Do you worry about that when you tell stories that involve other people, whether you change their names or not, that they will recognize themselves and be hurt by what they read or embarrassed by what they read?
Yeah, I'm always aware. I changed basically everyone's name who is in the book except for my parents, which is hard. It's hard to change your parents' names if you just say, you know, my dad, Mr. Jenkins. I don't think that flies.
Yeah.
And then with my parents, of course, and with my siblings, I was it was very important to me that I do them justice and be respectful. I did make one error, which we're going to fix in the second printing of the book, which my brother caught at one point, which is I tell a story about my sister Patty and how she was when she was a kid, when she was 13. She went on a trip to Austria, like a school trip to Austria, where my parents were chaperones. And my parents went to see some relatives, some distant relatives that we had there on a farm. And my sister Patty met them there, and it was a horse farm. And my sister Patty was drunk, and she had been drinking with a bunch of her friends, and she was plastered, and my mom was trying to get her to sit up straight, and she was like, Patty, she was like, don't you see they have horses, you know, don't you like horses? And my sister Patty, completely drunk, goes, I hate horses. And I printed this in the book, and then my brother called me, and he goes, I talked to Gina, my other sister, and she said that Patty is furious because when that happened, she was 17 years old, not 13 years old. And I was like, oh, no. And meanwhile, all I'm doing is just retelling it from here. I got it from that story from my mom, had told me that story. And so I printed it. But this is how family politics go. I call Patty immediately. I say, I'm really sorry. I said that you were 13 and not 17. And this is very telling of communication in the Birbiglia family. Patty goes, you did? I didn't even know that. So, it had come through the telephone game that Patty was furious, but in fact she hadn't even read it.
I asked for calls a few minutes ago, and I'm kind of worried about you now because...
I'm not getting calls.
No, you're getting calls, but the first call is in the wrong city, so maybe you shouldn't come here. Maybe you
tweeted it. Maybe that's why.
Well, Catherine is on the line from Columbus, Ohio. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to tell Mike that he's the man, and we
listened
to him on the way back and forth from the Rally to Restore Sanity this weekend, and it was great.
Oh, that's awesome. And how was that? Did you have there's so many people there. Was it was there sanity at all?
Well, it was, you know, it was reasonable insanity, I guess.
That is crazy. Well, thank you very much. I was actually on Jon Stewart did a benefit called Night of Too Many Stars. That was a telethon for Autism Speaks, Autism Education the other night. And I was, I was on the telethon. This is an example of my awkward situations, even more awkward continuing in my life. Jon Stewart comes over to me at the break and he goes, how's it going, Mike? And I go, it's good. I go, I'm pretty much just taking messages for Betty White and Tom Hanks, who are sitting right next to me, you know, and it's true, because the people would call the telethon, and they would be so disappointed when they were speaking to me and not Tom Hanks, you know, because how great would it be to talk to Tom Hanks? And so John goes, all right, when we come back, I'm going to go to you. And so we come back, and we're on air, and I'm now on a telephone call with someone else, and I'm talking to that person, so I'm not focused on what's happening on television. And John goes, Birbiglia, what are you doing? And I go, oh, I'm just on the phone. And I think he wanted me to just say the joke I had just said about Betty White and Tom Hanks, but I was too focused on the telephone call. And so then he had to fill in the blanks, so he goes, Birbiglia? He goes, no one wants to talk to Birbiglia? And it was so embarrassing because I was like, this is on television, right? You're saying this on live television that no one wants to speak with me? And it was painful, but it was very exciting also to be in that kind of insane company. That's a common theme in my life, is that I'm put in these situations where I'm well known enough to be asked to be in the situation, but not well known enough that the people in the situation know who I am.
Well, I would have loved to talk to you. I probably would have wanted to talk to Tom Hanks more, but
even my fans
want to talk to Tom Hanks more. All right. I know. You're telling me.
Thanks for your call, Catherine.
Yeah, no problem.
I appreciate it. I was going to ask you where the material comes from, but obviously the material, your whole life is fodder for this, isn't it? Everything that happens in your life could become the next story.
Yeah, I think that's the danger, with the next book is that we're now in the present tense, and these are people who I see every day, you know.
Well, you know,
wife, my friends.
Years ago, I used to work at the Steel Pier in Atlantic City, back in the day when they were still doing, bringing in vaudeville comedians and things like that. And I used to go and watch backstage these comedians whose names were Joan and Stanley Kane. They were married. And they were, I thought at the time, I was 13, 14, that they were blisteringly funny. And every summer they would come for a week and they'd do four shows a day. And they would do the same jokes in the same order every day. And you knew precisely where the laugh was.
Yeah.
And they, I think, did one shot on Ed Sullivan.
Mm-hmm.
And they said it nearly ruined their act. Because they were on television. Everybody in the country had seen their act. So they, you know,
That's what happened to me when I put out CDs and comedy specials. Is that before that I was skating, you know, for years with the same act for the first, you know, probably 6 or 7 years of my career, and then I put out two CDs, Two Drink Mike and My Secret Public Journal Live, and then all of a sudden, I couldn't do those jokes anymore.
Yes.
I couldn't tell those stories anymore.
Isn't that horrible?
You have to write a whole new act, and it's actually keeps you on your toes. Ultimately, I think it's probably good.
Yeah, but my God, it's a look. Well, I think there's a sitcom in your future, so you don't have to worry about that much longer. Don't you think?
Well, yeah, if sitcoms still exist, I don't
know.
We'll see.
Yeah, so
I'd like to make. I'd like to make films, and we're actually working. I'm working with Ira Glass right now on a screenplay adaptation of Sleepwalk with Me. So that's possibly what's next.
Get that little kid with the glasses who does the Christmas story. He's too old to do it now, to be you as a child. a comment from Peggy on our website. Mike, did you ever get justice from that horrible car accident? I think the story was called Scene of the Crime. It's maddening to think that wrong was never made right, she says.
Return to the Scene of the Crime on This American Life. No, I didn't, actually. That's one of the themes of I tell that story in my new one-man show and in the material that I'm doing this week in Charlotte. But I actually at the show, it's kind of cool. If people come, you'll see the accident report. We project it on the big screen so that everyone can see the injustice because I was hit by a drunk driver. I was hit by a drunk driver in Los Angeles and then made to pay for his car in this kind of strange loophole where the police officer made a mistake on the report and then he was unwilling to admit that he was wrong, and so I ended up paying for this drunk driver's car. And no I didn't get justice, but I think the story ultimately has a happy ending, which I won't give away.
Okay. You have to buy a ticket, huh?
Telling of it. Okay. Yeah, right.
She also wants to know if your show is safe for 12-year-olds.
12-year-olds?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, close call. It's like, I'd say that would be the cusp age. I probably in the hour and 10 minutes that I do on stage, I probably curse about once or twice, but I don't think in a way that's gratuitous. I don't know. I mean, people have different ways of qualifying things for kids, but certainly I'm much cleaner than 95% of comedians.
She doesn't specify whether the 12-year-old is a boy or a girl, and there you spent some time in your book talking about urologists. So is that in the act as well?
That's not in this show. It was in my last show, but I certainly spend a lot of time talking about my first kiss. Which is a very painful story.
You don't want to give that away either. Steve on the web writes, how do you feel about other comedians and the usage of wit and dry humor like Jimmy Carr?
How do I feel about it?
That's all I know.
Yeah, I like Jimmy Carr a lot. Actually, I ran into him up at Montreal at the Just for Laughs Festival this summer, and he came to my show. He was really sweet. He tweeted about it afterwards, and I think he is brilliant. I mean, the thing about Jimmy Carr, it's really interesting, is that he puts out a new hour of comedy every year, and then he throws it all away. He does an entirely new hour. He does a TV special, and then he throws it away. And he has probably like 7 or 8 hours of material.
Mm.
Really incredible. People should check him out if they don't know him. Jimmy Carr, he's a comic from the UK.
Why does he do that? Why does he throw it out? Why does he just... Why?
I think it's a discipline thing. I think he wants to always be, treading new territory and he just keeps himself focused. I mean, because I think, like we were talking about before, I think you can get away with doing the same material for years, but it's a self-challenge.
You know, one of the things that fascinates me about you and anybody who has a memory, which I don't, is that you have one. Is that you? In your stories, you go way back. I mean, you go back to the third grade in some of these stories.
Yeah.
You remember things enough to see it not only for the fact of the matter, but also through a funny lens. How do you remember things that happened to you in grade school? It's amazing to me.
Well, it's a process. Part of it is practical. I call people from my past.
Mm-hmm.
I call my friends and my neighbors, and I talk to my parents, and I talk to my siblings. And so, the more the more you remember, the more you remember. You know, the more you start to put things together, the more you go, oh, yeah, and that happened, and that happened. And, you know, when I was writing the book, I went back to Shrewsbury, Mass., which is where I grew up. I went back to my grade school. I went back to my middle school, and I went back to my old neighborhood. And, yeah, it's, you know, it's like researching your own life.
In the Carson era, comedians used to say if you got on Johnny's Tonight Show, it was a major break, particularly if he called you over to the desk. And you've done all the late night shows and Letterman and Jimmy Kimmel and probably Jon Stewart. I don't know. Can the same be said of those shows today? What's happened to those shows? They used to be hotbeds for new comedians.
Well, media is so fragmented at this point. There's, you know, instead of three networks, there's 190, mm-hmm. you know. There's so many different outlets that it's like every outlet is a different niche. It's a different group of people having their own type of entertainment. And, you know, these days you have to almost be on everything to be on, to be seen.
Well, you are.
I got to work on a show for the cooking network. Yeah.
Well, you are on everything, so congratulations to you. Sleep, Walk With Me, and Other Painfully True Stories is the name of the book by Mike Birbiglia, our guest this hour. And the Painfully True Stories tour comes to town Friday at 8 at the Knight Theater. Thank you for the hour.
Oh, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Good. Me too.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production.